know what it's like to, again, Donna, Elliot, you guys raised your hands to kind of have that awkward or weird Thanksgiving moment. And we all probably have been there at some point in our life where we've been at a meal or a dinner and things have just kind of gone south, have kind of gone the wrong way. And you just kind of start looking around, or you just kind of start looking down at your food or whatever. And this is kind of the scene that I think happens here with Jesus. So if you got a Bible, let's go to Luke 11. And we're going to start in verse 37. What I think I'll read, I think we'll have time to read the whole thing. I'm not going to talk about this whole passage. Again, if you're reading one of these Bibles, I always said I wish these Bibles had the little subheadings in them. This, from 37 to 54, the subheading for this is woes on the Pharisees and the experts in the law. Okay? So Jesus, again, is going to get he's pretty forthright with the Pharisees and the experts in the law. Maybe that would be a nice way of saying it. So 11:37 says, when Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. Now, let me just pause right here because I want to show you this. This is why we're going to talk about the Pharisees this morning. Because one of the first meals we discussed was dinner at Simon the Pharisee's house, right? So he has dinner at this guy Simon. This is where the woman anoints his feet with perfume, right? She's crying and as she makes a scene, it's this Simon girl. And then we're actually backtracking a little bit. We did the dinner at the prominent Pharisee's house. We spent a long time in there kind of talking about choosing that last seat, choosing the seat of death at like the Pharisee or the religious leader's house. And so we're kind of backtracking again because it says in 37, it says, Jesus finished speaking and a Pharisee invites to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table, right? So we've kind of did a little out of order, but again, we kind of go back and he's having another dinner at a Pharisee's house. And the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, wash his hands, right? Then the Lord said to him, now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But now as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you. And then he goes into these woes, right? And these woes are kind of like these rebukes, right? And he says, woe to you Pharisees, because you give a tenth of your mint, rue, and all kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. Woe to you Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplace. We've already talked about what seats we should be choosing, what seats we should be sitting in. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which people walk over without knowing it. Remember when I talked about, like, this is the kind of dinner party where it's like, did it just get awkward in here? Or is it just kind of like, Jesus is just going after these guys, right? To which one of these experts in the law is probably sitting there kind of like looking down at his food and kind of like, oh man, this is kind of getting weird, right? And he says, teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also, right? And what does Jesus do? Jesus goes, well, okay, you want to chime in? And you experts in the law, this is verse 46, woe to you because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will lift not one finger to help them. Woe to you because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they'll kill, and others they will persecute. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who is killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for all. Woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering. When Jesus went outside, I think this is what I was kind of after he dropped the microphone. When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. So you see how the dinner goes really wrong really quick, right? Jesus just starts getting into these guys. Now, what I want to do this morning, again, because I think that we've seen Jesus a lot at the Pharisees' house, and we have to kind of, I want to spend some time looking at the Pharisees this morning. Jesus' main opponent throughout the scriptures, besides sin, besides Satan, besides these evil forces, kind of comes in the realm of these Pharisees, right? He's always at odds with these folks. And I thought it would be good for us to spend some time this morning. Who are these people, right? And a lot of times when we think about the Pharisees, we just kind of have this cartoon character image of them, right? They're just kind of the morality police. They're just kind of the law police. And we think that they're just chasing us around with a rolling pin, just trying to bop us on the head whenever we do something wrong. I guess that, you guys didn't get that. That was, he's holding a scroll. No? Okay, good. Just making sure you guys are all paying attention. Destiny, you with me this morning?
No.
but we think sometimes with these Pharisees, we kind of think in cartoon images, don't we? Oh, they're just the, you know, kind of the morality police, or they're just kind of these little cops just chasing people around if they don't follow the law, or just, and we don't have, I don't think we have like a good, I want to talk about maybe kind of round out that image of who they were and the groups that actually existed within the Pharisees. So let's look at, I would say, the three sides of the Pharisees. When I was studying this past week and a half, there was just, this to me just opened up a whole new door into understanding Jesus's debates, discussions, confrontations within the scriptures. When I began to understand who the Pharisees were, what they are all about, and what's going on within this kind of Pharisaic movement. Okay, so let's talk about, I would say, the three sides of the Pharisees at first. First off is there's this religious side to them, right? They have this very strict adherence to the Torah, to the 613 commandments, right? In the Old Testament, there's 613 commandments. And the Pharisees, again, we have to understand that there is this very religious side of them where they wanted to follow the law and the Torah and these commandments and understand what they meant and how they applied to our lives, right? The classic example is when the Old Testament and the Ten Commandments says that you shouldn't do any work on the Sabbath. Well, what does that mean? Is it work for me to walk to the grocery store and pick up groceries, right? Is it work for me to prepare a meal on that day? What is work defined? When does a Sabbath begin? When does it end? All these little kind of rules and regulations that come around. So there's this very religious side that the Pharisees were zealous about trying to figure out the commandments and applying those to their lives, right? But then I would say that there is this other side of them. There is this very political side, right? The Pharisees were interested, and most of the Jews, but they were interested in the Messianic kingdom and its reign. And they were looking to purify themselves through these strict adherence to the Torah and its commandments to usher in this Messianic kingdom and its reign. This was a very political issue, right? It wasn't just, you know, sometimes we talk about religion, it's just like, oh, that's just your own private thing. Not for the Pharisees, it wasn't. There was a very political aspect of this where they were assuming that Yahweh was going to send the Messiah, and the Messiah was going to make things right. And there is a kingdom, there is politics, there was a power structure that would happen in all this, and he would be reigning over the land, right? Maybe a different way to understand this. When you think about Mormonism in Utah, is Mormonism in Utah just a private religion?
No.
No, right? Mormonism in Utah, Dustin, you might want to. It's very political, isn't it? Right? They have infected and affected the entire political structure to where when you think about Utah, right, and when you think about the state and the laws and the rules and the regulations that you can't buy alcohol on Sundays, right? Some places you can't at all. That there's all these. They have a very political dimension to Mormonism in the state of Utah, right? It's not just this kind of private religion. Think about this as another way to think about the Pharisees. One other thought that we could talk about would be when ISIS came to power, When ISIS came to power, one of the things that they were very hungry after was a region of land, right? They wanted that region of land kind of in between Iraq and Syria. That was very much part of their agenda. Their agenda, one of the things that we missed in the West as Americans, is we thought that ISIS and Al-Qaeda were the same thing. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden's idea was just kind of this worldwide network of terrorist cells. ISIS was very interested in establishing a caliphate in the Middle East, a region where this kind of political, theological leader would rise up and begin to usher in this new era for Islam in the Middle East, right? Even when we saw ISIS claiming responsibility for different terrorist activities around the world, ISIS, one of the things that we misunderstood about them is that they were never sending anybody from their political organization out into the world to go do these terrorist activities. The only thing that ISIS, the true ISIS, was interested in was establishing the caliphate, establishing this region, this land, this geographic proximity in the Middle East. And this is what the Pharisees were after as well, right? The Pharisees were after this political rule and reign where? In Jerusalem. This is where the Messiah was going to come, right? This is where Yahweh would send his chosen messenger. This is the land that we are going to reclaim. This is exactly what ISIS was after. And we've seen them on their very last leg recently, but they were after this rule and reign of this specific geographic location, okay? So again, when we think about the Pharisees, we can't just think about them as this kind of cartoon cop with chasing around laws. So there's the religious, there's the political, but then there's this activist kind of piece of it. They are pushing and pursuing an agenda. And the way I would compare that would be, anybody familiar with the organization Greenpeace? Most of us? What's Greenpeace all about?
Saving whales.
Saving whales? What else?
Save the environment. Save the mammals. Save the world.
Right. Greenpeace is all about kind of reducing, reusing, recycling, saving the world, saving the environment, go solar, drive a Prius, drought tolerant, protest the GMOs. But imagine if the Greenpeace people, right, in all of their activism, what Jesus kind of accuses the teachers of the law here, they just never lifted a finger to help anybody, right? They just sat there and they said, Jill, are you recycling? Are you really recycling? Are you composting? Are you dividing cans? Are you dividing cardboard? Eric, do you have solar on your house? Do you have drought tolerant? Oh, okay, you did the grass, so you're good on that. You need to install solar, but they never would say, well, let me come over and help you with that. Let me show you how to do these things, right? The Pharisees pushed and pursued this agenda, and they never were willing to lift a finger. This is what Jesus says. You're not willing to even lift a finger, right? The other thing I was thinking about would be within Greenpeace, imagine that leadership structure. They, behind the scenes, instead of trying to help Dustin make his house drought tolerant, instead of trying to help Ronnie drive a Prius to make him more efficient and, you know, all these sorts of things, imagine if behind the scenes, all that the leadership was doing was just backbiting and fighting and trying to climb on top of one another to claim more power and control. And this is kind of the act of what they were was happening behind the scenes with the Pharisees. So the three sides of the Pharisees, what I would say is, there's this religious side, there's this political side, there's this activist side, and it's not just, again, they're not just the morality police of the first century in Jerusalem. Okay, they have agendas, they are very political, and there is this massive religious piece to it. So that is the Pharisaic movement. Are you with me on that? Did I lose anybody so far? Within the Pharisaic movement, right, there's what I'm going to call two schools. Okay? Let me show you these two schools. There's Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. Who's heard of these two guys? Anybody heard of these two guys, a couple of you folks? Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. Bet means house, house of Hillel, House of Shammai, which would mean a school, right? Bet Hillel was started by a guy named Rabbi Hillel. He He was born in 110 BC in Babylon, and he died in about 10 AD in Jerusalem. He lived to be 120 years old. Yeah. Then you got Rabbi Shammai, who was born in about 50 BC, and he dies in about 30 AD. And I don't know if I would take these as exact dates. I don't know if we know if, but this is kind of the approximate frame. I mean, this was the best that I could find as far as dates go. But you kind of see that the time that these guys lived.
But we do know that Hillel had a Babylonian background, though, so he was born in exile?
I don't, because the exile ends, the Jews are welcomed back into Jerusalem. She's not liking church. Donna, what's going on? Is it my sermon? What's happening over there? She's... I thought it was my sermon. The cartoons. Maybe more cartoons, Donna? Come back, please. I'll show you more cartoons. as far as Babylon, I think that Babylon is still kind of Babylon as far as the outer lands, but I don't know if it would have been. The exile ends. What were you saying?
Is he born away from Jerusalem?
He's born away from Jerusalem.
Definitely. Okay.
Right.
So he is experiencing the exile kind of...
I think that they would be experiencing just kind of a more...
Dispersion.
Yeah, I would just kind of think that he just...
Exile ended in about the mid-400 BC, I think.
So the Jews were welcomed back in Jerusalem. There wasn't necessarily the geographic exile, but there was, we could say, like a political exile, because... Even though they were welcomed back into Jerusalem.
Okay, yeah, so they don't have...
autonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's still that kind of there's still that kind of, God, we're here in the land, but why are the pagans ruling over us, right? So he's born in this kind of, again, not experience. So he's born in Babylon, and then Shammai, I couldn't find out where Shammai was born. There wasn't any clear record on where he was born, but he's born in 50 BC and he dies in about 30 AD. Now let me talk to you a little bit about these two guys. These are both Pharisees. Okay. About 20 BC, so Hillel's kind of well on in years, and Shammai's kind of this up and comer, young guy. Hillel becomes what's called the president of the Sanhedrin, and Shammai becomes what's called the vice president of the Sanhedrin. Okay, the Sanhedrin is the Jewish ruling council. When we think about president, vice president, we think about two people from the same party, right? So we think about Trump and Pence, or we think about Obama and Biden, or we think about Bush and Cheney. You'd have to go back way, way back to the very beginning. Remember when, at the very beginning of our electoral process, the most popular vote becomes president, Thomas Jefferson. He's from the Democratic Republican Party. And then the person who gets the second most votes, doesn't matter what party it is, becomes vice president. So in this case, John Adams, who is from the Federalist Party, is the vice president. So they're two separate political parties. Okay. So when Hillel becomes president and Shammai becomes vice president, these aren't two guys that like are on, so to speak, the same page. They're very much opposed to one another. Okay. One of the things that there's about 316, and this is kind of all from kind of Jewish literature around the time, 316 separate records and controversies between the two groups. The house of Hillel, the school of Hillel, and the school of Shammai, they conflicted quite often. As a matter of fact, there's record that says some of Shammai's disciples, right? Do I have this? Some of Shammai's disciples actually are violent towards Hillel's disciples. They actually kill some of Hillel's disciples. They're that violent. They're that zealous for this group. This is, and I'll tell you why this is all important, because this is exactly the world that Jesus is operating in, this Hillel Shammai, right? So we can say this, that there was never one united Judaism. Sometimes you look back on Judaism and say, oh, it was all just one. No, in Judaism you have Pharisees, you have Sadducees, you have Herodians, you have Zealots, you have the Essenes. And then even in Phariseeism, you have the school of Hillel, you have the school of Shammai, you have all these little factions. It's about as dispersed as Christianity is today with all our little denominations, groups. There's just all over the place, right? There was never one united Judaism. There was a guy named Harvey Falk. He wrote this book called Jesus the Pharisee, and he talks about Jesus' connections to Phariseeism. and he says that when Shammai kind of comes on the scene, right? Shammai is this up-and-coming rabbi, this very learned, wise rabbi. Says his arrival caused the creation of two major and opposing schools of Pharisees, the house of Shammai, the house of Hillel, a situation that seldom existed in earlier times or afterwards. There is ample evidence of the strife and the division that it causes in Jewish life. One of the main divisions that they have, these two guys have, is that they don't know what to do about Gentiles. What do you do about the outsiders, right? Hillel, on one hand, said that you would follow, here's a new term for you. Anybody ever heard of the Noahide laws? The Noahide laws? This is some new material even for me. The Noahide laws were these commandments that Moses received, right? Noahide, children of Noah. Who's the children of Noah? Everyone, right? These commandments that Noah received, right? And he said that if you follow these seven, there were seven Noahide laws. Here, I'll read them to you real quick. They're just really kind of basic laws. It's don't worship idols, right? Don't curse God. Establish courts of justice. Don't commit murder. Don't commit adultery or sexual immorality. Don't steal or don't eat flesh from a living animal, right? Just kind of general laws. And Hillel says that if you follow these kind of general laws, that actually for a Gentile, for a pagan, for somebody outside of the Jewish faith, they could enter the life to come. They could have harmony, olam haba, with Yahweh, right? This is kind of what Hillel would teach. This is one of their big debates. Shammai said that the Noahide laws to have this life to come, this harmony with Yahweh, not only did you have to follow the Noahide laws, then you had to be circumcised, then you had to follow the Torah, the 613 laws, you had to literally become Jewish. Falk in his book says, the school of Shammai made it virtually impossible for even the most sincere and virtuous Gentile to find his way to salvation. Right? So in these two groups, you have this major debate on what to do with Gentiles. Do you see how this happens in the New Testament? Do you see this debate happening in the New Testament?
Peter and Paul,
right? I love this. Let me just read this to you. The Talmud, one of the Jewish documents of the early time. Let me just listen to this for a second. Close your eyes and listen to this. It explains that the disciples of Hillel were gentle and modest and studied both their own opinions and the opinions of the other school and humbly mentioned the words of the other school before their own. I have been just thinking about this all week. The Talmud explains that the disciples of Hillel were gentle and modest and studied both their own opinions and the opinions of the other school and humbly mentioned the words of the other school before their own. How much do we need that today? Right? Imagine this. Let me rephrase this. Disciples of Christ were gentle and modest. They studied both their opinions and the opinions of others, and humbly mentioned the words of the other school before their own. How often do we just go out with our bazookas of opinions and blast people with it without ever taking the time to understand what somebody else is going through? What their opinions are, what their thoughts are, what their heart is, right? So you have this massive divide between Hillel and Shammai, the president and the vice president, causes major strife. Hillel passes in again about 10 AD. Shammai gains control. The Talmud compares a day that Beth Shammai gained complete ascendancy. He passes something called the 18 measures. I'll get to that in a second. Overruling Bet Hillel. And the Talmud, this Jewish document, it says that this is about as good of a day as the God calf was built. You guys know what the God calf is? the golden calf, right? As Moses is up on Mount Sinai receiving these commandments of the Lord, the people are down on the ground building this golden calf, right? And this Jewish document, this Talmud, says that when Shammai gains control, that day is about as good of a day as the day of the golden calf, right? Not a very good day. Thank you for filling in that. Shammai enforces something called the 18 measures or 18 laws, and he adopts these to further distinguish, separate, and elevate Jews apart from Gentiles. He hunkers down. He doubles down in his separation, in his elevation, in his self-identification apart from the Gentiles. Segregation, superior, these underneath all of it is this arrogance that we are the chosen ones and nobody can come close to us, right? And he adopts even more measures, more laws to distinguish and alienate themselves from the Gentiles. Now, I got into all this Pharisaic talk. Here's why this is all important. Let me share a couple reasons why this is important. And then I think I'm going to get back to the text at some point. Maybe in another hour or two. When Jesus is engaging these debates and these discussions in the Gospels, right? And we miss this whole Jewish aspect of Jesus because we just think that Jesus was a Christian. Jesus is often addressing the issues of Hillel and Shammai, in which he often sides with Hillel, right? He often sides with the school of Hillel. Remember the school of Hillel, and just from a very brief understanding that we've looked at this morning, Hillel seems to be far more humble. Hillel seems to be have far more of a listening attitude. Hillel seems to be far more tolerant towards Gentiles, more inclusive towards Gentiles, whereas you see Shammai becomes very exclusive, very arrogant, very intolerant, very dogmatic, right? So when Jesus is addressing issues in the scriptures, debates, controversies, he is actually engaging in this Hillel-Shammai debate. This was the raging debate of the day, right? And we just miss this a lot of times. We just think that Jesus is, especially in this text, why is he getting so upset about hand washing? When you place Jesus' disputes within this Hillel-Shammai context, it's an important distinction because it offers the distinction of the perspective that Jesus' criticism literally was targeted at a specific sect of Pharisees and not at the Pharisees at large, right? Oftentimes, again, we think and we cartoon all of the Pharisees, oh, they're all bad. What Jesus often would go after is the Shammai, the school of Shammai, these Pharisees who have risen to power. Remember, when they rise to power, even within Judaism, they say, it was about as good as a day as when they built the golden calf. And Jesus is very critical of these people early on. In this text that we're in Luke 11, what Jesus is actually talking about is this whole controversy is about hand washing is a classic Hillel Shammai debate. This is exactly what he's getting after. This isn't just some random like, oh, this is a classic Hillel Shammai debate. Now let me show you how this works. Hillel and Shammai would do this. Shammai says that the hands must be washed before filling the cup of wine. So before I even filled the, let's say this, before I even filled the cup of wine this morning, I should have gone into the bathroom and washed my hand. Or Rob, did you fill it? Did you wash your hands before you did that? Oh, it's unclean, right? The whole thing, everything that happened this morning, this would all be unclean. We'd have to throw it all out because Rob did not wash his hands before filling the cup of wine. If your hands were unclean, right, and you touched the cup, the entire cup would be unclean. Now that just common sense doesn't make sense to us, right? Hillel would say that the washing should take place later, before the breaking of bread. In a Jewish meal, you first would have the cup. Everybody would take the cup. We'd pass it around. We'd drink the cup, right? And then you'd come together. After we all drank the cup, we would break the bread, okay? Now, Hillel would say that I should have washed my hands before I broke the bread. Would you guys agree with me?
Yes.
Okay, I did wash my hands, just so you guys are... So they would say, good insight, they would say that you should wash your hands, would happen later before this breaking of the bread. This is from Hillel. Hillel would say that if a vessel's outer part was rendered unclean, right? Even if I touch this outer part, if my hands were unwashed, if Rob's hands were unwashed, we're not going to say, oh man, Rob didn't wash his hands, let's throw out the wine, right? Hillel understood that their inner part remains clean. But if Rob's hands were unclean and he just started sticking his hands down and around the wine, we would say, yeah, this kind of thing is kind of nasty. Let's get some new wine, right? So this debate that Jesus launches into here is just this classic Hillel Shammai debate, right? And this happens all throughout the New Testament. And we just think like, oh, he's just kind of this weird. Jesus is often entering into these controversies, into these debates. Uh-oh. There's all this debates that still rage on.
And they still have, you have to have a separate kosher kitchen. Mm-hmm. And a kind of same thing today.
Let me just say this, and then I want to give just a little bit of perspective on this. Jesus utilizes this contemporary argument.
Loud morning.
It's a what?
Loud morning.
Loud morning. And he exploits it to make a poignant and timeless truth, which we all see and understand today, right? We all know that you can, like, you can be, on the outside, it can be a little bit dirty, right? But if the inside's fine, it's okay. But when the inside's corrupted, it doesn't matter how clean the outside of the glass is. And we understand that that's true with us today. You can come to church, right? And you can kind of on the outside look kind of grimy and grungy, but if your heart is pure, we know that, right? And you can come to church and you could be the best dressed. You can come to Jesus, you could look so good and everything could be perfect and polished and your family could look all wonderful. And on the inside, your heart could be corrupt, right? Your heart could be full of greed, could be full of darkness. And so Jesus, what he does in this passage, what's fascinating is he just says, okay, well, what's a kind of contemporary argument of the day? Like, what are we talking about here? You want to criticize me for washing my hands? And then he just takes that and he makes this truth, which we just all understand clear as day today. If you don't understand how brilliant Jesus was and how sharp and how smart he was, I just hope that one day you'll just be like, wow, this guy had some brains going on, right? Let me share three quick things. Because I've loved the Pharisaic discussion and understand the Pharisees and how that relates to me reading the Gospels. When I read the Gospels and see what Jesus is doing, I think on its own it's just worth its value. Let me share three other things. Jesus is always elevating dualistic, polarizing conversations. We've talked about this a lot, and I at one point I did this phenomenal whiteboard drawing with a lot of scribbling on it. And we always talk about how we get into these kind of dualistic, polarizing conversations, don't we? How many conversations are you hearing today about Republican or Democrat, right? Liberal or conservative? Somebody's pro-life or pro-choice. Somebody's either Second Amendment supporter or gun control supporter. We either have the good people or the bad people. We either have the sinners or the saints. We either have it's us versus them. There's all these dualistic, polarizing conversations that the world tries us to suck us down into. Right? Even with this controversy, even with this, it's just this dualistic argument about when do you wash the hands, wine or bread, right? And Jesus always does this. It's such a good reminder for us, is that as we look at these simplistic, polarizing conversations that the world tries to sell to us, we ask, Jesus, what is the real issue at stake here, right? Jesus would bring it to a different plane, and he discusses, this is what he says in verses 37 through 41, is he says, you Pharisees, you're clean on the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness, right? It's not about when you wash your hands. It says, as now it's for inside you, be generous to the poor, be merciful to the poor, and everything will be clean for you, right? Do you want to be pure? Do you want to be clean? It's not about when you wash your hands, before the wine, before the bread. It's not this simple, dualistic, polarizing conversation that they were involved in. Jesus would always, always point up to a new conversation. I love that, you know, Paul, when he would teach his followers, especially these young pastors that he had his boy Timothy. You know, Paul always would pour into this guy Timothy. And he got a hold of this, and he would say something like this. He'd say, Paul writing to Timothy, "Hey, Timothy, again I say," so again, he must have had to say this to him before, "don't get involved in foolish, ignorant arguments that only start fights. A servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but must be kind to everyone, be able to teach, and be patient with difficult people." That could just be somebody's life verse right there. Yes. Right? A servant of the Lord is not going to quarrel, not going to get in all these little silly arguments and fights, is going to be kind to people, is going to be able to teach, and be patient with difficult people. Right? Paul says to Timothy, "Gently instruct those who oppose the truth. Perhaps God will change those people's hearts, and they will learn the truth." He says to his boy Titus, "Hey Titus, don't get involved in foolish discussions about spiritual pedigrees or in quarrels and fights about obedience to Jewish laws. These things are useless and a waste of time." Right? And so Jesus, I think that he would always elevate out of these simplistic, dualistic conversations, these polarizing conversations, and he would go up here. What is the real issue at stake? For the Pharisees here, Jesus pointed right, how are you treating the poor? How are you treating the marginalized? How are you treating the hurting? Right? The second thing I would say too is if you find yourself at Thanksgiving dinner or at Christmas dinner and you're involved in these dualistic, these polarizing conversations, sometimes it's good to just kind of take a step back and you say, "Okay, Lord, show me this person's heart." Right? I was reading in my friend Jan's book. She just released a book called When the Soul Listens, and she tells this story about she was in this committee at her church, and there was this one particular guy in this committee who was just wanting to upset the apple cart, right? Just wanted to do everything different. Just didn't want people telling him what to do. And there's this committee of people, and then there's this guy, and there's just obviously this tension and this frustration, and Jan's really frustrated. And there's just anger and harsh words being said. And then Jan says she picks up her son from some event, and she was just telling him about, you know, this person and how this meeting went and how difficult it was. And her son says to Jan, her son says, "Oh yeah, that guy that he's so antagonistic, he was in Vietnam and he spent his whole life being told what to do. People are always telling him what to do, right? And, you know, now that he's in this situation," and she's like, "Oh, I saw this person's heart. They have always been told what to do." And so they get into this committee, and this committee's trying to what?
Tell
him what to do. And he just, like, he just rebels against that. And so she sees that in his heart. Sometimes we get in these dualistic conversations, and again, we go back to what the disciples of Hillel would do. And we would say, we just kind of are maybe need to be more gentle and just kind of humbly consider other people's opinions instead of just trying to be, "Oh, I'm going to tell people what's what," right? Imagine you're in one of these dualistic, these polarizing conversations, and you just take a step back and you say, "Okay, Lord, show me this person's heart." I've been thinking about that little phrase for quite some time as I just think, like, Jesus knew these guys' hearts, right? He knew what the issue was. And he was able to speak really to the issue, to their hearts, instead of just getting involved in this hand-washing debate, right? So again, I would say asking the Lord to show you their heart. And then the last thing I would say, I love this, the cure for hypocrisy isn't transparency, it's solidarity with the poor, right? The cure for hypocrisy isn't just transparency, it's solidarity with the poor. Jesus didn't encourage them to, "Hey, you guys need to just follow the Torah more. You need to take the 18 measures more seriously. You need to be careful about how you wash your hands." He didn't give them more sacrifices to do. He didn't give him counseling. He didn't just say, hey, go just kind of do generic random acts of kindness. Jesus says, I love how this is in the NLT, clean the inside by giving gifts to the poor, and you will be clean all over. Jesus' cure for the hypocrisy that he found in the Pharisees was to be have solidarity with the poor. The way this works for me is like this. I got a meeting this week. I'm on the Garden Grove Community Foundation. And the Community Foundation is a kind of a part that exists within Garden Grove, and it's just a nonprofit. We help put on the summer concerts in the park. We help just promote and advocate for community and community places within the city. And in this meeting that I've been a part of this foundation for a couple years, but we have like our kind of big Christmas kind of meeting this week. Now the mayor's there. City council members are there. City staff is there, right? Now, when I go to this meeting, what am I going to do? You kind of got to step your game up a little bit. You know what I'm talking about? You kind of got to elevate yourself. You don't go to a meeting with a mayor and with all these kind of people and just kind of go there in board shorts, tank tops, and a sombrero, right? Like you go and you present yourself and you kind of step. You guys know what I'm talking about? Anybody? Am I talking to anybody? Polish right? Yourself. Thank you. You polish yourself a little bit. You know, maybe you have a party that you're going to this Christmas season. You're like, oh, man, that person's going to be there. And that person, I kind of got to set my game. I got to polish myself. I got to watch my P's and Q's. Or you're have that meeting at school or at work that you're kind of like, I kind of put a little bit of impression here. Right. So we know that when we go up the social ladder, right, we're a little bit more likely to, we could say, where's my man Nathan this morning? We're more likely to posture a little bit. We're more likely to kind of act up, or not act up, but act kind of up to that level a little bit, right? But what happens instead of going to this like, ooh, wow, the mayor's there and city council and all these important people are there, what happens when you go the other way, right? Let me say it like this. What happens, here's a picture of Cass serving whiskey to these old grandmas here. What happens when you're just going to hang out with just kind of, and I don't want to say that these ladies are poor, but just kind of when you kind of go down, so to speak, the social ladder, right? Are you more or less likely to posture, to act pretentious, to put on a big scene when you go down the social ladder?
It's really all up to you.
You're not, right? When you go serve at the soup kitchen, which we'll probably go do in a couple, you're not there to impress people. You're not there to make a whole scene of yourself. You're not there to dress up and look the part. You're just there to serve, to be who you are. And so I think when Jesus talks about hypocrisy, I see that the cure for hypocrisy, all the ways that we try and act pretentious, all the ways that we try and act fake, all the ways that we try and posture or that we're phony when we go up the ladder, it doesn't happen when you go down and you show solidarity with the poor. Jesus says, you hypocrites, right? And then he finishes by saying, give gifts, be with the poor. Spend time with the poor. Spend time with those who are marginalized, who are outcast. Because in that, right, in that, you're far less likely, when you sit with the poor, when you sit with those who are poor in spirit, and when you just are, just kind of plain as can be, that's when God is with you. I think that's probably enough for today. Maybe one of these three things would help you. Jesus is always elevating these dualistic conversations, these polarizing conversations that our society seems to be so fascinated with. Maybe it'd be helpful if you have somebody that you're in contention with right now. You really just pray and ask that God would show you their heart. And maybe you've just found yourself posturing. Maybe you found yourself kind of putting on that mask. And God's just saying, why don't you show some gifts and some solidarity and some love for those who are poor, those who are poor in spirit. Let me say a word of prayer and let's have a little discussion. I hope, Lord, that we were able to see you, Jesus, we were able to see you in a more clear way this morning. I hope you were able to show us something of who you are, of what you engaged in, what battles you had to fight, how brilliant you were, how merciful you were, how wise you were. We want to model ourselves in that way. Jesus, we just want to be like you. Help us. In the name of Christ. Amen. Okay, some thoughts. What are some initial words that would come to mind when you would hear Pharisee? I think a large part of this portion was just to kind of clear what that word and who the Pharisees were. In what new way, religious, political, or activist, did you encounter the Pharisees? How might understanding the debates of Hillel and Shammai help deepen your understanding of Jesus and what Jesus was going through? And then those last three points, elevating conversations, kind of getting away from those dualistic, polarizing conversations. Asking the Lord to show me their heart, showing somebody else's heart, or solidarity with the poor. What point did you resonate with and why?